Hello, this is Tim Simpson, and this is my world. I am an author, and I've written over 40 books that are on Audible right now, and each month I'm going to upload 2 hours of audiobooks. They'll be the first book of a series, and I hope that you enjoy it. They'll be absolutely free for you to listen, so download and enjoy.
Part 2, Sunrise. Chapter 9. Her room was kept dark. She claimed the sun hurt her eyes. She slept sound. She heard nothing, especially in the fog that crept in through the closed shutters of her bedchamber. She could not feel the fog as it crept up underneath her warm bed coverings. She could not feel it sliding over her bare feet. She was still a very beautiful woman. Her auburn hair lay about her head as she slept. Her figure was like that of a young woman. She was what every man dreamed about but could never obtain. The fog filled the sheets of the sleeping woman slowly as it moved up to her beautiful head, as it began to take shape into that of a man. His arms formed around the thin waist of the Countess. His head took shape on the pillow beside hers. In only a moment, Countess Elizabeth Bathory awoke with dagger in her hand, turning to her intruder, who grabbed her wrist mid-air.
"Why do you desire to take the life of the one you worked so hard to resurrect?" Dracula asked, looking deep into her eyes.
"What do you want from me?" Dracula said, not removing his stare.
"I want to live forever," she said, dagger in her hand. "It is a lonely life," he said, as he drew his face closer to hers. "Not if we have each other," she said, dropping the blade and throwing her arms around Dracula and pressing her lips to his as hard as she could. "I want you to bite me," she whispered in his ear as their bodies began to tangle into each other. "Now is not the time, my dear, but please rest assured you will become like me, but for now my body will have to suffice," he said as he pressed his lips against hers once again. The Countess has been waiting her whole life for this very moment, and now she had the man she loved beside her in her arms. Her whole being ached for him, and he only wanted to give her all that she wanted of him and more. The passion could be felt even to the ends of the earth. All of the vampires that were now in hiding for fear of the sun could feel all that Dracula, their master, was feeling, and even though these creatures had no life of humanity left in them, they could feel the passion between Dracula and his lover.
Chapter 10. The captain sat at his desk, drinking his morning coffee, as his first mate came walking through his door.
"Sir, I have just realized where I heard his name before," Starbuck said.
Captain Ahab looked up from his morning brew.
"Please do tell," he said, leaning back in chair.
"From here,"
the first mate said, throwing a paperback novel onto Ahab's desk.
"Sherlock Holmes, so he is somewhat a famous fellow, I would say," said Ahab, scratching his scruffy beard, flipping through the pages of the well-read book.
"Yes, sir, I have read many of his exploits over a long night in my bunk," Starbuck said.
"Well, have you met the gentleman yet?"
Ahab asked with a sly grin.
"No, sir, I was not present when he boarded the Pequod, sir."
"Then by all means you should meet this man," Ahab said, taking a sip of his strong brew.
"Ah, good morning, amigos,"
said Diego as he stepped into the little eating room that was set aside for Ahab's guest.
"Tell me, my friend, do you always carry a sword on your side like that?"
Van Helsing asked as he and Holmes sat sipping their breakfast tea.
"Ah, mi amigo, this sword and I have been through a lot together," the Don said as he pulled out a chair to sit with his new comrades.
Don Diego de la Vega was older now, but still kept himself physically fit, wearing traditional Spanish clothing of bright colours, as seemed was his custom. They looked very dated to the two Englishmen. However, neither Holmes nor Van Helsing made any comments to Diego about his attire. Diego sat pouring a glass of tea with his new friends.
"So, Mr. Holmes, how is it you know the captain of this vessel?" Diego asked.
"I don't really know him per se. I have heard of him through different local channels, and what I had gathered, this used to be a whaling vessel of sorts. From my understanding, the captain had some sort of dreadful experience with a beast of the sea, and now he mostly works for hire, aiding others that are in need of passage across the waters," Holmes said as he dropped another sugar cube into his tea.
"What an interesting life this must be, but I could never do it," Diego said with a grin.
"Oh, and what would be the hindrance?" said Holmes.
"No, senoritas," Diego said as they all enjoyed a laugh.
You gentlemen know that this mission we are about to undertake could possibly end all of our lives, Van Helsing said in a matter-of-fact manner. The tone of the other two men dropped as well.
Yes, the only thing that is certain is that nothing is certain, Holmes said, setting his tea down.
Please tell me more of this count in which you spoke last night, Diego said.
He is a vile creature of most unholy intentions. He is not living, yet he walks about in a body of imagined flesh, pretending to be alive. He is cursed with a wretched disease known as vampirism. His unholy blood is in a constant thirst for the living life force. As far as I know, he is the first of his kind. Once he was a great Count Prince, a murderous fiend the likes of which no human has ever known. He was a warrior who battled and tortured humans unlike anything anyone had ever seen before. And when he met his end, well, Van Helsing said, pausing only a moment to gather his words. Well, death could not even stop him. He just became a curse on humanity. He slaughtered millions of innocent lives before he vanished into his home, where, after many years later, an unsuspecting lad came to his house, and the fiend fell in love with the lad's bride-to-be, and that is when I was first contacted. He moved far from his home and continued his reign of terror. It was horrible, the things he had accomplished before I could lead a group of men to vanquish the beast on his own ground. Van Helsing paused as if in a trance, taking a sip of his tea. No one made a sound as he continued. I eventually killed the beast and took his remains and hid them away behind various traps, he said as he stopped and looked at his new friends. And now it appears my nightmare continues.
I do have a question, Mr. Van Helsing, Holmes interjected.
Of course, Mr. Holmes, please by all means ask, Van Helsing said.
Why were you contacted about such a creature in the first place?
Holmes asked. Very good, Mr. Holmes. Very good indeed. I have spent most of my adult life studying the occult and creatures that were thought to be simply myth. I just knew deep down that these creatures were not simply creatures of legend, but could actually live in our time, Van Helsing answered and then continued. However, this Dracula was the first I had ever encountered firsthand, he finished.
Excuse me, mi amigos, but how do you know the beast lives? Asked Diego as he sat enthralled in the fanciful story with all the enthusiasm of a child listening to a late-night tale by the fire.
One of his minions said the master lives. That can only mean one thing. You see, somehow all of the people he infects have some sort of mental bond. It's a medical marvel, really, that these things run the earth as they do. On my travels after Dracula's demise, I found these beasts seemed to come from everywhere. I have been eluding them for years now, killing as many as I could in the process, but they keep multiplying.
Won't you come join us, sir? Holmes said as he looked behind Diego and at the ship's first mate standing in the doorways, as both Diego and Van Helsing turned to look.
Please excuse the interruption, sir, but are you not Mr. Sherlock Holmes? Asked the first mate.
Yes, sir, I am. Please come in. Would you like a spot of tea? Holmes asked as he motioned to an empty chair near Diego.
Sir, I have thoroughly enjoyed reading all of your exploits, the first mate said as he sat in his chair.
Well, my friend, that was a lifetime ago, and a lot of my dear friend Watson's imagination, I am afraid, Holmes chuckled.
Well, could you scribble your name in this for me, please, said the first mate, handing Holmes a worn-out book.
Ah, yes, The Hound of the Baskervilles, Watson's favourite tale, Holmes said as he scribbled his name in the book.
I am sorry, gents, but I could not help overhearing about vampires. Do they really exist? Asked the curious first mate.
Yes, son, I am afraid they do, Van Helsing said in his usual abrupt manner.
But how could such a creature keep themselves hidden away?
I, for one, sir, I have never seen such a thing in all my travels, the first mate said.
They are not as hidden as you might think. They mainly choose small villages that have very few visitors, some place where they can terrorize the citizens without any worry of reproach. Dracula himself came from a small village. However, he made the mistake of moving in on a well-populated area.
Well, then he made his biggest mistake ever, Van Helsing continued.
And that is, sir? The first mate asked.
He fell for a woman, and she ultimately was his demise, said Van Helsing as Holmes raised a glass.
Hear, hear, he said as he swallowed the last of his tea.
Am I to understand that this heartless beast fell for a woman?
Diego asked, sounding very intrigued.
Yes, she reminded him of a lost love, Van Helsing said.
So then, what kind of a beast could he be? Asked Diego as he pressed on.
Well, sir, you did have first-hand account of the beautiful creature that you so solemnly decapitated, Van Helsing asked.
Well, gentlemen, most of the greatest nations have fallen when men so carelessly give their hearts to a woman, Holmes said as he stared into his empty cup.
Mr. Holmes, am I to believe you do not have a woman somewhere awaiting your return? Diego said, leaning closer to Holmes.
He did once, chimed the first mate. Her name was Irene, he said, looking at Diego.
Yes, I see you have been reading. There was a woman once. She was the most beautiful I have ever seen, Holmes said.
And what happened? Diego asked with a sly grin.
She undoubtedly tore my heart from my chest and burned it to a cinder whilst I watched.
The three men sat staring, none of them exactly sure as to what to say.
Oh, Mr. Holmes, you didn't happen to bring your violin, did you? Asked the first mate.
Holmes turned to the man as if shaking himself from a far-off daze.
Yes, actually, I did, Holmes said.
Would you oblige us with a tune? The men and I love the musical arts, the first mate pleaded.
Yes, of course, I will go and get it, Holmes said as he stood up and made his way to the door.
You gents don't truly realise who that man is, the first mate said as he watched Holmes disappear through the doorway.
Chapter 11. He sees the claws ripping unmercifully. He can see the wolf fighting, doing all that he can against the uneven odds. And then Dr. Jekyll does the unthinkable. He throws himself in the middle of it all. He is alone, without Hyde. He sees the faces of the creatures, and then his eyes open. The night is left, and the day is bright. During the battle, the light arose over the hills, causing the vampires to flee to safety, leaving the injured wolf behind.
What happened? Larry asked as he turned his head slightly toward his friend, who was sitting in a chair beside his bed.
We need to leave, now, was all that Dr. Jekyll said as he sat staring at his friend.
Larry Collins, still disoriented, tries to sit up, but found it difficult.
I am sorry, Larry, but you changed last night, as did I, said the doctor.
Doctor, what happened to my arm? Larry asked as he looked at a bandaged stump.
I am sorry, Larry, they were trying to tear you apart, and almost succeeded. They ripped your arm off. I managed to cauterize it so it would not get infected,
Dr. Jekyll said solemnly.
But what manner of beast could have done such a thing to me?
Larry asked as tears began welling up in his eyes at the sight of the stump where his arms had once been.
They were creatures unlike any I have ever seen, more powerful than you and I together. I awoke amidst broken limbs. Something must have thrown Hyde through the trees. Only a true monster could have achieved that. Now we need to leave before the townspeople realize that we were a part of their horror last night, Dr. Jekyll said as he stood up. Come, I have our bags packed, he said as he headed toward the door.
The two travelers rushed to make their way out of the little inn. Talk had already begun about the strangers, the very ones that occupied the tavern.
Come, I know you are in great pain, but, my friend, we need to keep moving or we will surely meet our fate in this town,
Jekyll said as he took his friend by his good arm and led him towards the dense wooded area that marked the edge of the small village. The forest surrounding most villages were taboo. No one wanted to travel into them unless you were a member of the authorities. The stories told by the elders about the wooded areas were simply to try and keep children from entering them and getting lost. However, most of the horror stories were true.
We need to keep moving, Larry. If we stop, someone could still spot us,
Dr. Jekyll said as he held to his friend.
Arm hurts so badly,
Larry said as he tried to keep up with his friend. At that moment, a noise to the left of the two men caught Dr. Jekyll's attention.
Did you hear that?
Jekyll asked as he eased his friend close to a tree to rest.
No. Wait. Yes, I hear something,
Larry said, clutching the tree with his good arm. Dr. Jekyll slowly walked around the town to see from where the noise came. As he made his way around the tree, the first thing to catch his eye was a pile of ashes lying on the ground. As he got closer, he could see from where the noise was coming. A young woman of probably 16 lay on the ground close to the tree, trying to shield her lace from the deadly rays of the sun. However, her legs were not so lucky, and now they lay in a pile of ash just below her torso. She was moaning in obvious pain.
"Please help me," she said as her eyes spotted Dr. Jekyll. "You tried to kill us last night,"
Jekyll said, coming to a stop at where her legs had once been.
"It was my master. It wasn't I," she pleaded from the ground. "You are an abomination. I cannot in good conscience let you live,"
Jekyll said, now kneeling beside the helpless vampire.
"I know you," she said with a hiss. "You're that insane doctor that thought his life was so miserable that he wanted to become someone or something else,"
she said, clutching to the tree, trying to avoid the direct sunlight.
"I did make a mistake. On that account I have never questioned. However, I do wish to rectify my mistake. But you are evil, as evil a thing as I have ever seen. But I am not," Dr. Jekyll said.
"You may not be, but that one, the one inside you, He is very evil, and you will get to a point where you cannot control him any longer, and then you will be worse than any of us, she said with another hiss.
Goodbye, ma'am. We must be leaving now, Jekyll said as he stood up.
A word of caution. Stay away from the next town. You will not like what you will find there, she said with an evil chuckle.
Maybe not, but I don't see how it could be any worse than where we have just been, he said, standing and picking up his bag. You know, when the sun gets any higher, this tree won't help you much, he said as he turned to leave.
We will get you, and your pathetic matters.
Well, you just wait. You will see. Her words trailed off as Dr. Jekyll took his friend by the arm as they headed down the partially covered trail. Dr. Jekyll was not a little man. He was a good 190 pounds. He had curly black hair that had started to turn grey. He wore spectacles on his face only in times of study. He was always a well-dressed man, but lately he wore just a plain white shirt with sleeves always rolled up to the elbow, black slacks, and sometimes a top coat to combat the cold.
Come on, Larry, just a little further, he said as he helped his friend along the pathway.
Chapter 12.
This is the journal of Professor James Moriarty. I have uncovered the Frankenstein creation, and am still a marvel at how the brilliant Dr. Frankenstein was able to achieve such a feat. However, I have taken custody of the monster and placed him in a safe location where I hope to be able to finish what the esteemed Dr. Frankenstein had started. Dr. Griffin and I found the beast frozen in ice in the Arctic upon the request of our employer, the Countess Elizabeth Bathory. Griffin and I travelled to the furthest reaches possible and claimed the monster for her. Her intentions for the creature are unknown by me, and as far as I know, unknown to Griffin as well. However, being a man of science myself, I want to see the creature grow and learn from our world. He is, of course, disfigured due to the time he spent below surface of the freezing waters of the north. Due to the severity of the weather, I fear some damage has been done to his brain. I need some time with him, to talk with him and study his motor skills, to determine how far gone the brain is. Thus far, he is having trouble with speech, so I will begin there. There is, however, no doubt, once the Countess finds us missing, her anger will not be able to be kindled. I do not know her plan fully. What I do know is she means to exact her revenge on anything and anyone that stands in her way, be it human or otherwise, and I believe there is no one on earth that can stop her. The last I heard, she recovered a mystical mummy and the remains of Count Dracula himself. Make no mistake, she will stop at nothing to see this plan to its fullest. I know, deep down, that she will find us, but I have to protect the creation at all costs. This might actually be the way us humans can outdefy death itself without becoming some immortal monster. I cannot... No, I will not let my son fall into her hands. So, Doctor, I send this journal entry to you in the hopes that you will use all of your considerable resources and help save the people of this side of the world, because if not, trust me, it will reach you soon enough. I know you never thought you would ever hear from me again, but I have no one in which to turn. Dr. Watson, if you have not gone into the great beyond, please help these people from a certain inhumane death, and at all cost. Help the Frankenstein creation, and do not let Bathory lay her hands upon him. She, I am sure, means only to dissect him and use his body parts, and try to gain immortality in doing so. I will rush this entry as soon as we get settled. Professor Moriarty.
Chapter 13. The shades were all drawn, and she lay in the giant bed, the covers all tousled, her enormous pillows thrown about the room, but she had a sheer look of satisfaction on her countenance.
"That was better than I ever imagined," she said as she lay in bed, staring at the ceiling.
"Well, if you have lived as long as I have, you would have learned a thing or two about the fairer sex,"
the Count Dracula said as he walked around the bedchambers, looking at the Countess's collection of artifacts from all over the world.
"Tell me, Countess, what is it you hope to achieve in uniting all of these beasts?" he asked, stopping in front of a sarcophagus standing in the corner of her room.
The Countess sat up, letting her hair fall, covering her breast.
"I want total control of my homeland, and then the rest of the world," she said in a pouty way.
"Really?" he said over his shoulder.
"That is a foolish dream for a foolish woman. The most you will achieve is causing terror throughout the land, and most likely only a local terror at that."
It will only become stories in the far regions of the world. Nothing more than tales of monsters roaming the countryside, Dracula said, looking back at the mummy. And what of him? He asked as he nodded to the mummified king. The countess slowly climbed out of bed and walked over to her count.
Oh yes, his name is Khufu. He was the second pharaoh of the fourth dynasty. He was a great ruler. And it is believed when he died that a curse was born, and that his power has grown over the years that he sleeps, and when he awakens he will— The countess started, but pausing as she turned towards her lover. Be even more powerful than you, she had said, stroking the arm of the count. Well then, let's hope you never figure out how to awaken such a powerful creature, Dracula said as he looked into the eyes of the countess. I have so many more, she said, turning from his stare. In the basement I have secured the Frankenstein monster. I also have two wonderfully brilliant doctors, one who remains invisible, and even the headless Hessian at my command, she said as she seductively walked back to the canopied bed. Yes, you have worked hard for what you have achieved, long hours no doubt, but such powerful creatures will not always stay contained, he said as he followed behind her. You must surely know this, the count continued. Just outside the countess's bedchamber someone was listening, too scared to enter, knowing the countess had a severe temper, and fearing how she would respond to the disappearance of Professor Moriarty and the monster. He stands quietly, trying to find a peaceful solution to this enormous problem, and he has no fear of being caught outside the door, since he is invisible to the naked eyes anyway. He stands his back against the wall, literally and figuratively. There is only one solution to this calamity, and that is he must go and find the monster himself. No one would even know he was gone. He could slip out, find the monster, and bring him back. Besides, how far could they have gone? The professor was not a young man, and towing a lumbering giant with him could not be easy. The thoughts raced through his mind, trying not to let the panic disrupt his rational thoughts. Yes, I will go now, and no one will ever be the wiser, Griffin thought as he turned and ran down the long staircasing. But what if Moriarty will not let me have the beast? He thought. And then I will have to rid the world of the most evil villain ever known to exist. I will be a hero either way. I have killed before, Griffin thought as he headed out the front entrance of the mansion. I can do this. Chapter 14. Holmes slid his bow across the strings of his violin and it made a lively sound. The sailors all loved the music as some danced and clapped their hands. Holmes had never felt such energy and camaraderie. Holmes had always preferred solitude for his life, even with his close friend Watson. In the last several years he had come to miss his old friend's company. Once Watson married Mary, he could not see him as often as he liked, so the loneliness began to set in. Retirement was an easy decision for Holmes to make. Watson was busy with his wife, and his life had completely outgrown Sherlock Holmes. He knew it was his own doing, and to be honest, the whole reason he was here now had very little to do with the destruction of his cabin, and more to do with a feel of adrenaline running through his tired, worn-out veins once more. Holmes had come to appreciate the company of his new friends. His only regret was that Watson was not here to share in this with him. He would have cherished such a mysterious case as this. He first wanted to lay the blame on Watson's newfound love, Mary, but he liked Mary, even though he would never admit it to anyone, not even to himself. Holmes had aged better than most. A lot of his hair was still coal black. However, some grey had started gaining new ground around the temples. His face was now even skinnier than before. It was once joked that he had two profiles looking for a face. He was now clean-shaven. Once aboard the ship, he shed the beard that had begun to fill out his sunken cheekbones a bit. Holmes pulled the bow across the strings of the violin with newfound vigour as he watched the sailors enjoying his music even more now. He had to admit he was enjoying himself as much as the sailors were, and even his new friends, Don Diego de la Vega and Abraham Van Helsing. May I accompany you, amigo? Diego de la Vega said as he stepped out onto the deck of the ship, carrying his bohuela. Holmes paused for just a minute. Well, my friend, I have never played with one of those before, but I am always up for new ventures, Holmes said with a chuckle to a round of cheers from the crew. Not enjoying the music, sir? Captain Ahab said as he walked up behind Van Helsing, who by now had found himself a corner in which to stand and observe the entertainment. I find it hard to celebrate with such a dark task ahead of us, Van Helsing said as he continued to watch his friends make their music. Your friends do not seem to have trouble with your endeavours, Captain Ahab said as he watched his men enjoying the music as well. Well, sir, they have not yet witnessed the true things which are about to be revealed, Van Helsing said, taking his eyes away from the festivities.
I was once obsessed with an evil creature of the deep, so much so my life revolved around the beast. I couldn't enjoy such things as this fine music, wine, or even the company of a beautiful woman without wanting to find this beast that took my leg. I know some day I will find him, but I cannot let it consume me. I'll make no mistake, we will cross paths again. But for now, I have given up hunting the beast, and just hire out my boat and its services to people like yourself, Ahab said, looking toward Van Helsing, who was now staring toward the ground, taking in all that Ahab had said. Have you ever heard of the Frankenstein monster? Ahab asked without warning. Van Helsing shot a strong look up toward the captain. I have heard the legends and the rumors, like everyone else, I suppose, Van Helsing said, not sure where this conversation was leading. Well, I have seen it, Ahab said as he pulled a wooden pipe from his long seaman's coat. What do you mean? Asked Van Helsing, stepping close to the captain, as if a great secret was about to be revealed. That's right, you heard me correctly. I have seen the monster, Ahab said, placing the pipe in his mouth under his moustache. How have you seen this? Van Helsing asked, very intrigued now. It was about 3 months ago. Two men came to me, wanting a charter way out to the Arctic, said they planned to make a discovery that the world would hear about, Ahab began as he puffed on his pipe. We travelled for over 3 weeks, searching for what? I had no idea. What were the names of these two men? Do you remember? Asked Van Helsing. Well, that's another story altogether. Neither would give a full name, and with the funds they were sharing, I really did not care what their true identities were, Ahab said with a chuckle and another puff. So you took two unnamed men to the Arctic without as much as a name? Asked Van Helsing over the roar of the sailors and of the music Holmes and Diego were making. As I said, they paid very well. My man and I needed the money, so we agreed, no questions asked. But how do you know it was the Frankenstein monster? Van Helsing asked, sounding a little sceptical now. Ah, now that is the question. How indeed? My crew and I had seen the two men and their party dragging something across the ice. My crew had brought the hunk of ice aboard my ship, and then... Then it was larger than life, Ahab said as he exhaled a puff of black smoke from his mouth. What is it? Van Helsing asked impatiently. Staring up from that block of ice were two pairs of cold, dead eyes, looking right at me. At first I demanded it be placed back into the ocean from which it came, but I believe the thing came from hell, and knew there would be no way to take it that far down. Then the strange man, covered in rags and bandages, offered yet even more payment, so we stored the beast down below, packed it in ice, the captain said as he stared off into some unseen distance. Tell me of the man in the rags, Van Helsing said, now very curious. Well, he wore dark glasses, and not an inch of flesh shone about his body. Completely covered he was, Ahab said, trying to remember as many details as possible. And what of the other mysterious gentleman? Asked Van Helsing. He seemed ordinary enough, an older man, very thin and gaunt. He had a slight limp. He was balding and much more talkative than the other one. He was a very intelligent man, that there was no doubt, Ahab said, holding his pipe just below his beard, trying hard to remember. Van Helsing turned away from the captain, trying to take in all that he had heard. There is something very sinister going on here, Van Helsing said as he looked toward Holmes' location. Holmes met his gaze with his own, and deducing from the expression on Van Helsing's face, something was afoot. Well, gentlemen, I believe I need to lay my arm to rest. It appears I am not as young as I would like to believe me to be, Holmes said, placing his violin to the side and rising to his feet. A few of the crew groaned in protest, but slowly departed and headed back to their neglected duties. Diego, following Holmes' cue, also placed his instrument away and followed behind Holmes to the place where Captain Ahab and Van Helsing were talking. Well, that was some fine playing, said Ahab as Holmes approached. Thank you, Captain. It has been quite some time since I have been requested to play such a lively tune, Holmes said, stopping in front of the two men. Will you please excuse us, Captain? I do need to talk to my friends here about our next course of action to take, Van Helsing said as he took Holmes by the arm and led him and Diego to the side. What is the trouble, Abraham? Holmes asked as they stopped beside the portside railing. I believe things are far worse than we originally imagined, Van Helsing said with a sense of panic in his voice that Holmes picked up upon immediately. Diego leaned in close to Van Helsing so the rest of the crew would not overhear them. Senor, what do you mean? I was speaking with the captain and he was telling me. Van Helsing paused, not even sure he wanted to utter the forthcoming words out loud. Have either one of you ever heard of the Frankenstein monster? Van Helsing said, pulling a handkerchief from his pocket to wipe his forehead.
Correct me if I am wrong, but Frankenstein was the scientist looking to reanimate dead tissues, am I right? Holmes asked.
Yes, Mr. Holmes, you are, Van Helsing said with a sense of relief.
I believe I read a paper on him once a long time ago. If my memory serves, the scientific community as a whole was trying to denounce any type of research he was attempting, Holmes said, folding his arms and running his index finger along his narrow chin.
Yes, Mr. Holmes, you are correct. However, he succeeded, without any permission from any science board, and he created a monster using dead flesh, Van Helsing said, sitting on a wooden bench.
Ah, gentlemen, we are not young schoolboys to believe such legends and terror stories to scare little children, Diego said with his usual smile. Mr. De La Vega, do I need to remind you again of the beast in which you separated body from head? Holmes said, still in his posture of calculating what he was hearing.
So, now do we think this is some grand coincidence, or are the resurrection of Dracula related to the Frankenstein's monster related? Holmes said as he began to pace.
First, Van Helsing, Holmes said, doing a spin on the heel of his boot. Do we know whatever happened to the monster? I mean, where did his demise take place?
Well, no one really knows for certain, only that the monster terrorized the Frankenstein family, even killing a few members before Frankenstein ended up disappearing with the monster.
Van Helsing said, searching in his mind, trying to recount the stories.
Okay, so now we know the story. Do we believe the monster is alive?
Don Diego said.
Yes, and in fact it was brought onto this very vessel,
Van Helsing said, looking at his two companions.
Very interesting, Holmes said. As he reached into the pocket of his Inverness coat, he pulled out his pipe.
Do we know who brought him on board? Asked Holmes, lighting his pipe.
The captain does not remember his name,
Van Helsing said.
Yes, I can see how that is possible. He is not the most sociable of men. However, his first mate seemed to be very sociable. I imagine it took a while to locate the monster, at least 2 months, and in that time our friend Starbuck must have spoken to the men that chartered this ship, Holmes said, stopping only to puff harder on his pipe.
I need to speak to the first mate. The two of you talk to the crew, see if anyone has seen or heard anything about the creature,
Holmes said as he turned to go.
Oh, and gentlemen, be discreet, remember, the game is afoot, Holmes said as he paused by the cabin door.
Chapter 15.
The woods were thick and hard to travel, especially trying to carry a wounded friend.
Please, Jekyll, just let me perish here. My arm, it hurts so badly. I don't want to live a day or longer,
Larry said as he was fighting the pain with all he had.
I am sorry, Larry. The town cannot be much further. Please, just hang on a little longer,
Dr. Jekyll said as he pushed through the thick underbrush. Inside, Jekyll knew once nightfall was upon them, they would not survive, especially with the infestation of vampire as thick as they were in the area. He could hear the sound of people up ahead.
Not far now, Jekyll said to his wounded friend.
What do you think that woman meant by we won't like what we find in the next village?
Larry asked.
I don't know, but I am willing to risk it. At worst, we can pose as vampire victims and find refuge,
Jekyll said, trying hard to devise a plan. Jekyll could see a clearing up ahead.
Larry, we made it, he said as he pushed through the last of the bush.
In his sight was a small village with people hustling all over the busy street. As they got closer, Jekyll could hear some of what the villagers were saying.
My son, where is my son? And things like, they took my daughter.
Oh no, this town was hit as well,
Jekyll thought to himself as he approached the first of the little buildings. He could see people lying out in the streets, and some were crouching over fallen loved ones.
Oh my gracious, I have to do something,
Jekyll said as he eased his friend down onto the first porch he could find.
Wait here, I will return, he said to his friend as he turned to go out into the chaos.
Larry sat, holding the stump where his arm had been, as he watched Jekyll leaning over the vampire victims, doing what he could with his little medical bag. He thought how this kind, caring man could turn into such a monster that had caused so much fear throughout all of London. As Jekyll leaned over the first girl he came to, he could see the marks on her neck very close. The mother was kneeling on both knees beside her daughter. Looking around, Jekyll could see the streets were littered with soon-to-be vampires. Their families did not want to move them for fear of killing their loved ones, so they lay in the street, presumably awaiting help. Jekyll knew help was not coming, and at nightfall the change would take place, and the whole town and its inhabitants would all either be vampires or dead, and in most cases, both. Jekyll slowly rose to his feet and made it back to where he had left Larry sitting.
We have to get out of here, now!
Jekyll whispered to his friend, turning slightly to look at all of the hurting people.
Why? I thought we could find refuge here, Larry said.
No, we can't stay. You know by nightfall all of these people will become vampires, and we can't risk it.
Jekyll leaned low so no one would hear.
We have to make our way out now, Jekyll said with a sense of urgency.
Are you a doctor? Asked an older man as he came running up behind Dr. Jekyll.
Yes, I am, or I mean I was, Jekyll stammered, turning to face the man.
Could you please help my son? Pleaded the old man.
Sir, do you realise what it was that attacked you last night, and what truly has taken place here? Asked Jekyll very sternly.
Yes, it was the undead. They rose up against us for our sins and slaughtered our families as payment, the old said as tears welled up in his eyes.
Sir, I can assure you it has nothing to do with your sons and everything to do with their bloodlust, Jekyll said, turning back toward his friend.
How do you know this? The old man pressed.
Because I escaped an attack in another town, Jekyll said, helping Larry to his feet. You see, they took my friend's arm, Jekyll said.
Please, you must help us. The only doctor was killed. Please, sir. Please, we will all die here without your help,
the old man said as he clung to Jekyll's shirt sleeve, falling to his knees. Jekyll paused to look around. Sir, I must be firm. If everyone who has been bitten is not killed immediately, they will become those horrible monsters tonight and kill every one of you like sheep, Jekyll said as he pulled his arm free of the old man.
As Jekyll walked, he tried not to step on any of the bodies lying in the street. Are we really going to leave these people at the mercy of the vampires? Larry asked as he staggered along.
What would you have me do? Asked Jekyll.
I don't know, maybe we are doing the right thing in leaving, Larry said, trying to watch where he was stepping.
Besides, if the vampires come and we are here, chances are Hyde will show up and your furry friend, and then the whole town will be levelled to rubble, and there will be no one left alive, Jekyll reasoned as the two men made it to the edge of the little village. They turned to take one last look. The people were in so much pain they would not stand a chance.
I think we should stay, Larry said.
If we do, we both will most likely be dead by morning, Doc. We have been running for years now and are no closer to finding a cure for Hyde or the wolf.
I think fate has led us here, maybe. Who knows, we might win. But if we don't stay, would we really be any worse off than we are now? Larry reasoned.
Jekyll paused a moment. He looked over the area and watched as the villagers scrambled about trying to hang on to their lives. Okay, but remember, this was all your idea, Jekyll said as he led his friend back into the little village.
Chapter 16.
Where am I?
The creature said as he stumbled for words.
You are in your new home. I am James Moriarty, and I want to help you, my friend, Professor Moriarty said.
The little house sat far back into the woods. One side was an 80-foot drop straight into the water. The other side was a mountain. The only way in or out was down an old path that had grown up over the years.
Help me,
the monster said as he shook his head, trying to gather his scattered thoughts.
Dead. I wanted to be, the monster said, looking toward the ground.
No, Moriarty said, rising from his writing table.
You must live. You have to live, the professor said. I need you to live, he said, resting in front of the creature. Why was I born?
You were born into chaos, but you will live in peace now, the professor assured the Goliath.
I will teach you things you have never known. I will show you a side of humanity you have not yet experienced.
You will be great, he continued. But I first need to examine you to see what has been damaged, Moriarty said, grabbing his medical bag.
My eye, I can't see, the monster said.
Which one? Moriarty asked.
This one,
the monster said, putting a hand on his left eye.
Lay back and let me look at you. Tell me, who taught you to speak? I looked at family speaking,
the monster said as he messed up his vowels. It sounds like they might have been French, Moriarty said, referring to the monster's accent. Moriarty worked tirelessly, checking all of the creature's motor skills and functions that his limited medical equipment would allow him to do.
Professor Moriarty's journal. After thoroughly examining the Frankenstein creation, I have reached the worst of conclusions. It seems we have brought life back into the monster, to only have natural course to take it away again. His brain is severely damaged on the right side. The flesh on his bones continues to decay as if he were still in the ground. He has very little mobility in his joints and partial paralysis in his left hand and leg, possibly due to the damage to his brain or tissue damage from the severe cold temperature. My final analysis would be I would give him only a few days to live, and two at the most before his organs shut down completely.
I must say it is a travesty so much we could have learned from this magnificent creature. Now I must sit here and watch him disappear before my very eyes.
Chapter 17.
"Excuse me, Mr. Starbuck, may I have a word with you?" asked Holmes, stepping into the first mate's cabin.
"Of course, Mr. Holmes. Please come in. Anything for the great detective."
"Thank you, sir, but I will be as brief as possible. I am curious about a charter you had a few months back. An unusual charter, I might add, one involving a frozen corpse,"
Holmes said as he casually looked around the first mate's quarters.
"Oh, I can never forget such an eerie thing as that, Mr. Holmes," the first mate said, falling in a sitting position on his bunk.
"Mr. Holmes, sheer words could not explain what I saw in that ice," the first mate said as he stared toward the deck.
"I understand. However, if you had a name, that would be most helpful," Holmes asked.
"Well, one of the strange gentlemen was a bit more conversational than the other, so I pressed him and he gave me a name, but swore me to secrecy, Mr. Holmes," the first mate said.
"It has been more than a few months now since you made that promise," Holmes pressed. "I do not believe you will see either one of those gentlemen again."
"He insisted I call him Mr. Remans," Owen began, as he realized Holmes was right.
"He seemed very intelligent, Mr. Holmes. Not someone who would be digging in the ice in the middle of the Arctic," First Mate Starbuck said.
"The other guy, his partner, on the other hand, never spoke to anyone except Mr. Remans. In fact, I never even saw him much at all. He was always covered head to foot. On the rare time I did see him walking about below deck, he was still covered."
"Well, Mr. Starbuck, you have been most helpful," Holmes said, walking to the door.
"Mr. Holmes, are you working on a real case? I truly did not give you much to detect on."
"No, I am afraid not, my dear boy. Just curious this time around. Anyway, I have long since retired. And if I were working on a case, you, my friend, gave me plenty to detect on," Holmes said with a grin, trying to cover his deceit.
"Oh, there is one other thing, Mr. Holmes," said the first mate, before Holmes even reached the door.
"Oh, yes, and what is that?" Holmes said, turning to face the man.
"Mr. Remans must have been a doctor or something, because I heard the bandaged man call him Professor once."
The look on Holmes' face told the boy that Holmes recognized something in his statement.
"Thank you, young man," Holmes said as he ushered himself out of the cabin.
"Well, no one seems to know anything about the strangers," said Don Diego as he stepped into his cabin, where Van Helsing had already seated.
"Do you really think they were bringing the Frankenstein monster on board this very ship?"
Diego asked.
"I do," Holmes said as he walked in behind Diego.
"What have you found out?" Van Helsing asked, looking up toward Holmes.
"You might want to get a cup of tea ready," Holmes said as he pulled a chair out from the small round table.
The three men sat at the table as they each poured small amounts of tea into their cups.
"Well, Mr. Starbuck had quite a bit to say, even though he had no idea what he was saying," Holmes said as he took a sip of tea.
"Please tell me more, senor," Diego said, listening.
"One of the men's names was Mr. Remans. Now, of course, we know that is not his real name," Holmes said, taking another sip.
"Oh, how do we know this?" asked Van Helsing.
"Oh, well, elementary. Let Mr. Remans quickly roll off of your tongue, and what have you got?"
"Okay, Mr. Remans," Van Helsing said.
"Much faster," Holmes pushed.
"Mr. Remans," Diego said.
"Exactly," Holmes said. "Mr. Remans."
"Well, that does not tell us anything," Van Helsing said with a sound of frustration.
"There is more. Starbuck also said that the bandaged man called our mystery man Professor," Holmes said.
"Okay, so we have a professor calling himself a mystery man. What does all of this mean?" Diego asked.
"Well, if anyone can piece together the whereabouts of the lost creature and keep his identity a complete mystery in the process, it would be a professor, not just any professor. A professor I thought was long dead," Holmes said.
"Then you know this man that has the creature?" Van Helsing asked, now twitching in his chair.
"It can only be Professor Moriarty, the Napoleon of crime, my old nemesis," Holmes said with a bit of unbelief in his voice.
"I had never heard of this man," Diego said.
"Not many have. Moriarty ran a crime circuit in Great Britain. Well, all over Europe, actually. However, he was based in my part of the world. The biggest, most compelling question here is why would he care about such a creature? And furthermore, to what end could this mean for him?"
Holmes asked, but not expecting an answer, knowing neither of his companions could offer any.
"All right, gentlemen, if this is indeed the work of Moriarty, then we are dealing with the most devious and diabolical mind the world has ever known. He could be orchestrating everything from Dracula's resurrection to the finding of Frankenstein's creature," Holmes concluded.
"If what you say is true, he has no way of controlling such power," Van Helsing interjected.
"I do not believe at this late stage of his life he cares much about controlling them, as he is just releasing them," Holmes said. "In this case, we should have the captain take us to where he dropped Moriarty and the mystery bandaged man, if indeed he is Moriarty," Diego said.
"No, we need to cover more ground," Holmes said.
We need to separate and check out the tomb of Dracula. Van Helsing, you are the only one that knows where that is. I will go and find my old enemy. Granted, he will most likely be long gone by now, but it could also be where he has set up his base of operation, Holmes said, looking at both his new friends.
I don't know about separating. That could be the advantage they need over us, Diego said.
We have no choice. Dracula could indeed still be in the area of the tomb, in which case both he and Moriarty need to be stopped, and the Frankenstein monster found before Moriarty figures out how to reanimate it, if that is at all possible, Holmes said with a sense of urgency in his voice.
I agree, Holmes. We need to cover as much ground as possible, Van Helsing said.
Okay, what of me? Asked Diego. You will need to accompany Mr. Van Helsing, because from what we have seen, Dracula's army is much greater than Moriarty's. My hopes are the two are not collaborating in any way, Holmes said.
My dear Mr. Holmes, if your professor has anything to do with Dracula, chances are very good he has already met his fate. It has been my experience Dracula works with no one but himself, Van Helsing asked.
Okay, let us go inform the captain on our change of plans, Diego said.
Yes, let's go at once and hope we are not too late, Holmes confirmed.
Part 3. The Darkest Night. Chapter 18. The sun started to set, sending a faint glow into the window of Countess Elizabeth Bathory de Exed. It covers her bed like a shadow, showing the outline of her perfect form as the satin sheets covered her nude body. It is almost time to feed, her lover said as he looked out over the well-manicured courtyard.
I want to be first, the seductive countess said, rising from her bed, letting the satin fall.
I want to live forever with you, my love, she said as she strolled up behind the count, placing her arms around his abdomen.
When the time is right, my dear, you will be. But your humanity makes you more powerful than you realize for the moment, the count said as he turned to the countess.
What do you mean, my love? She asked.
You have a plan. You have succeeded in capturing and acquiring some very unusual beings and having them do your bidding. The day is for you. You must finish what you have begun. Then, once all of the pieces are in place, I will make you my bride, the count said as he pressed his lips to Bathory's. But now I must awaken my army and cover this land as far as the very eye can see and feed on every living human we can find and show them that we are the supreme beings and they are mere cattle for the slaughtering, Dracula said as he flung open the shutters to the great window. He walked onto the balcony.
It is time, my minions, rise up and feed, he shouted, lifting his arms high into the air.
Like the sound of wind rushing over the land, winged creatures came from all directions, bursting from the caves out of the ground and from the basements of houses. From all directions they came. Dracula suddenly, without warning, turned to Bathory. As he turned, his appearance changed into a horrible winged beast.
Fear not, my dear. You also will have your day of reckoning, he said as his giant wings began to flap and lift him off of the ground.
Chapter 19.
Please, sirs, take my daughter, she said with pleading eyes.
I am sorry, ma'am, but we cannot do that,
Dr. Jekyll said as he closed his medical bag.
She has no hope with us, the woman pleaded again.
Doctor, you might want to inject me now, Larry said, interrupting the woman.
Dr. Jekyll turned to see the sun setting.
No, not tonight, my friend, Jekyll said as he turned back to the lady. Send your daughter to the woods just outside of town, and tell her to make no sounds or she will be killed with the rest of us, Jekyll said as the woman gasped and clutched her mouth.
You better go now, he finished as he walked toward the door.
Let's go, Larry. I fear the change has already started, he said, opening the door.
Jekyll was always able to keep a cool demeanor, even in times of stress, which is one of the reasons he was a very good physician. He spoke in a calm voice, never hurried, always in control, which is another reason he secretly enjoyed becoming Hyde, so he could let loose of his darker side. The only side effect was Hyde had no control, and Jekyll had it all. The carnage in the street was now much worse than before. The infected citizens began to convulse and twitch. Some were reaching out and grabbing anyone passing by and sinking their new fangs in any part of the body they could reach just to quench the burning hunger.
They are young vampires, Dr. Jekyll said without any emotion. They do not know how to aim their newfound strength, it seems. They are as wild, dangerous animals, he said as he stepped from the porch onto the street.
We have done all we can for the wounded, Larry. It's time we leave, Jekyll said in a very calm manner.
You're right, Doctor,
asked Larry, who had forgot about the pain in his arm, and was looking around at all of the once motionless bodies beginning to spring violently to life.
I am as all right as I can be. Larry, let's take our leave now, Dr. Jekyll said very coldly.
As the sky grew darker, the screams got louder. Family members were attacking family members. People were running all around the village, trying to hide from their loved ones. The infected people were now leaping to their feet and attacking in force. Dr. Jekyll seemed to block it all out as he walked down the center of the street in the direction of the woods. Larry could feel the burning inside his guts. He could see the moon rising.
Dr. Jekyll, he said as he stumbled and fell. I am sorry, Larry, but this is the end. You must set free. These creatures will kill us both, either as human or as our true nature. You must go, my friend. Kill as many as you can. That will be your contribution to humanity, your penance, as it were, Dr. Jekyll said, turning his eyes from his friend's transformation. Maybe one day we will meet up again and continue our journey, the doctor said as he turned to leave his friend.
Larry's missing arm began to grow, first stretching to the ground. He was on his knees as the burning continued. He threw his head back to pay homage to the one that called him forth as he howled at the moon. The wolf's blood now consumed his body. His eyes scanned his surroundings, trying to comprehend with his primitive canine brain where it was he had awakened. His mind was a jumble, but he could see something that could fill his hungry belly, and there were a lot of them running everywhere. Dr. Jekyll had done what he felt necessary. His friend was a wolf he had given up long ago on trying to find a cure for him. He realized that something born of a curse could not be cured with science. He had never told his friend he was doomed to walk the earth as an animal forever. He just enjoyed his friendship, but always knowing that one day they would have to part ways. They each had their own destinies, and his was not to die in a small town devoured by vampires, so he made his way out of the town, using the cover of the thick trees as his shield.
Please, sir, let me come with you,
a small voice said just below the thicket of bushes. Dr. Jekyll looked down and could see a young woman of around 20, long blonde hair and dark brown eyes. Her clothes were tattered.
My mother said you told her to bring me here,
she said, trying to whisper so as not to be discovered by the evil that was now devouring the village.
Yes, I did,
Dr. Jekyll said as he reached a hand down to help the young woman to her feet.
Are you not afraid of the beasts?
She asked as she stood.
It is dying I am not afraid of any more, he said as she stood face to face with him.
Something seemed to change deep inside him while working with the villagers. He could see how the sickness was taking over their bodies. They were not dead, but yet not alive either. He made up his mind then and there that should the time come, he himself would end his own life before becoming an abomination such as that.
Come, follow me, Dr. Jekyll said as he led the girl through the forest. Tell me what your name is,
Jekyll asked as he pushed some bushes out of his way.
My name is Sarah,
the girl said as she followed behind Jekyll.
Look,
the girl said as she pointed to the sky with a small amount of pain in her voice. The sky started clouding over with familiar shadows of giant wings.
You thought I would forget you,
a voice said from somewhere behind Jekyll and Sarah.
I see you have your legs back,
Jekyll said, recognizing the female vampire who once had her legs burnt to cinders.
You see, the night heals all our wounds, Jekyll, and makes us whole again,
the vampire stated as she looked towards the sky, her arms straight to her side as she circled.
And now it's time to tear you apart,
she said with a wide grin that revealed her fangs. No one heard him, but he was there, watching for the moment of action. Foam dripped from the corners of his hungry mouth. Somewhere deep inside him, he wanted revenge, but was not exactly sure why. He lunged at the vampire, his fangs showing his claws out in front of him. His sharp eyes were focused when he hit the vampire hard against her chest. Jekyll and Sarah both jumped from fright at the suddenness of the attack. Neither expected the wolf to be there. The wolf landed, trapping the vampire underneath him. She reached to grab the wolf by the throat, and he immediately grabbed her arm in his gaping jaws and ripped and tore until she screamed in pain as her arm was ripped from her body. Almost instantly, creatures started dropping from the sky all around Jekyll and Sarah. The wolf turned to face the overwhelming odds.
You might want to stay behind me,
Jekyll said to Sarah, pushing her directly behind his back. The vampires, for the most part, started turning back into something that resembled a little more human form.
Okay, let's face.
Hello, this is Tim Simpson, and this is my world. I am an author, and I've written over 40 books that are on Audible right now. And each month I'm going to upload 2 hours of audiobooks. They'll be the first book of a series, and I hope that you enjoy it. They'll be absolutely free for you to listen. So download and enjoy.
Chapter 20.
"Please calm down, it's just a little rain," Moriarty said, trying to hold the big creature back on the bed. "You must not exert yourself," he insisted.
"Must find father," the creature said, trying to sit up.
"Your father is dead, you must not exert yourself," Moriarty said, trying to calm the monster.
"I knew you would be here," a voice said as it came from somewhere in the corner of the darkened cabin.
"Griffin, what are you doing here?" Moriarty said, standing to his feet.
"Wondering why you have betrayed the Countess in this manner," the voice said as it got closer.
"You have no idea of her plans," Moriarty said with an angry voice.
"How did you transport him here so quickly?" Griffin asked as he was still looking over the room.
"I used a boat," Moriarty said as he scanned the room with his eyes, trying to catch a glimpse of the invisible man.
"You cannot control him alone," Griffin said as he circled the room.
"I do not mean to control him. He is dying and will most likely be dead by morning," Moriarty said, looking back at the creature, which had a surprised look on his grotesque face.
"We do not need him alive," Griffin said. "We just need to know how to bring him to life. Just the science behind it, nothing more," he finished.
"Well, you know, you were there. Now leave us alone," Moriarty said as he slid a hand into his pocket.
The rain beat down hard on the old cabin. Every time the thunder cracked, the monster would jump, but Professor James Moriarty stood firm in front of the beast.
"Do you expect me to believe that the so-called Napoleon of Crime has a soft spot in his black heart for such an inhuman animal?"
Griffin asked, still moving around the room unseen, so Moriarty could not get a lock on his presence. The noise was loud, the light was bright when the lightning from the sea crashed into the side of the cabin, igniting it instantly. Moriarty went sailing into his work table. The monster was hit directly in the chest by the lightning bolt. The screams the monster made was enough to curdle the blood. The fire engulfed the room. The monster rose off of the bed with newfound vigour, flailing around, blinded by the smoke, trying in vain to find an exit. Griffin opened his eye to see his leg had caught fire. He quickly patted out the flames off his leg. He could see the giant monster swinging his arms, looking for a way out. Griffin rapidly searched the room, looking for an opening himself when he spotted the hole from the lightning. He knew he could be free. He made his move to the opening and without thought lunged through it. The monster made his way to the door and smashed it to splinters as he found his way out. He stepped into the night air, and as the lightning lit the sky, the monster let out an earth-shattering scream up at the night to announce finally he was free. The monster's yell woke Moriarty, who was lying unconscious by his writing table, which had also caught fire. He scrambled to his feet, his head was bleeding profusely and showed no signs of stopping. He finally, after some struggling, made it to his feet to see where the monster had gone. The thunder crashed louder than anything he had ever heard before. He raced outside, but saw nothing. "The monster must have gone," he thought as he headed down the path. Both of his legs were now broken. He could feel the bone protruding from one of his shins. He could not see it, however, but he knew it was there. He looked up from the hard ground in which he was now lying. He could barely see through the hard rain as he lay on his back, but he could tell that he had fallen pretty far when jumping through the hole inside the cabin's wall. It looked to be at least a 20-foot drop, or so he estimated. He could feel both legs were broken on impact.
"Moriarty!" Griffin called out, but the thunder was much louder, and his words fell only on his own ears. "Moriarty, help me!"
he shouted again, but nothing was returned. He lay on the cliff as the rain beat down on his invisible, naked body, contemplating finishing what he started by rolling off the cliff and ending it all. The path was dark and had grown over, but he had been here many times as a getaway from the Countess and her lunacy, as he put it. Griffin must have followed him here on some occasions to be able to find him so quickly. He struggled with his footing. He was not a young man anymore. A man of almost 70 years, and with a bad leg to boot, he struggled down the steep mountain. Finally, he came to a rest against a tree.
"Go, my friend, and terrorize the world as you wish," said Moriarty as he gave up and slid down to the base of the tree to rest.
Chapter 21.
"Go now and make sure he is not in the tomb," Holmes said to his friends as they prepared to board the small dinghy to take Diego and Van Helsing ashore.
"Mr. Holmes, if we never meet again, it was truly an honour," Diego said as he shook the hand of Sherlock Holmes.
Rest assured, Mr. Holmes. I will find the Count, and this time he will not be returning, Van Helsing said, tossing the rest of his equipment into the small craft.
Once we have finished our mission, gentlemen, we will meet back at my cabin and decide our next course of action to take, agreed?
Holmes said as he placed a hand on each of the men's shoulders.
Yes, we will meet you back at the cabin, Van Helsing said.
Holmes stood on deck as he watched the craft sail off into the night, heading to shore.
So long, my friends, Holmes said to himself,
as he watched the boat disappeared into the night.
The small craft hit the sand as the two men began to disembark for their mission. They each grabbed their belongings and headed inland.
Looks like a storm's coming in, Van Helsing said, adjusting his hat.
How far is this storm, anyway? Diego asked as he grabbed his bag from the boat.
Not too much further, if my memory is still good,
Van Helsing said as he started up the banks to the mainland.
If I remember correctly, there is a small village just ahead,
Van Helsing said as the two men travelled up the small incline.
There it is. I guess your memory was right,
Diego said, pointing in the small distance. He could make out the shapes of the buildings.
No, the cemetery should not be much further,
Van Helsing said as they started to pick up some speed.
The town seems to be awfully quiet for this time of night,
Diego observed.
Yes, something must have happened here,
Van Helsing said as he looked at the holes in all of the walls of the buildings.
It looks like people were slaughtered,
Diego said, referring to all of the red covering the streets.
We had better tread lightly, my friend,
Van Helsing said as he set his crossbow to fire.
Yes, I agree, amigo, Diego said as he drew his sword.
The two men proceeded as silently as all of their training had allowed them to be, for men of such an advanced age, anyway.
I feel we are being watched,
Diego said as he looked toward the rooftops.
We are,
Van Helsing said as he spotted a window curtain move.
Let's just keep moving,
Diego said as they kept moving forward. The dusty ground helped them move swiftly as their boots slid across it softly. Still, no one made themselves known.
I figure whatever happened here, these people are frightened of us,
Van Helsing said as they reached the gate of the cemetery.
Why, of all the places in the world, did you decide to put the remains of Dracula here?
Asked Diego as he opened the gate to enter the cemetery. It creaked eerily as both men half expected it would.
Because this is such a remote spot, I figured no one would even think to look for his remains here,
Van Helsing answered as he entered the gate. The cemetery seemed darker than the street. There were no trees, just headstones and monuments that shadowed the ground from the cloud-covered moon. The two men walked carefully, not fully knowing what to expect from such a dismal place. There was no sound at all, not from any living creature or dead ones.
Here is one, Van Helsing said as he took a torch from off of the wall beside the door. Do you have a match?
Van Helsing asked. Diego set his bag down and dug out one from his pocket and handed it to the vampire hunter. Van Helsing lit the torch and entered the dark tomb.